The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Mark Fauber. David, the reason we're having Mark on, we have him on numerous times throughout the year, but this is key because there are some key announcements coming out in the middle of September. This is pre-election that could really affect the entire fall.
Mark is pretty good at calling inflection points, and when he sees things both from a fundamental and technical standpoint on knife's edge, he's willing to call it like it is. Looking at the middle of the month, next month, we have the ECB meetings and the Fed governor's meetings. We have those combined, and what has been built into the system in terms of pricing may come right back out. And being cautious, being concerned about where the equities markets are, this is something we want to engage with Mark today. And, you know, where are we at? Where are we going? We want to look back at the first decade of this new century, and frankly, we've seen a remarkable number of transitions, trends that have been put in place. Mark, to your mind, what are the primary trends that are in place, and what might alter their course?
Well, I think that if you look at the years 1980 to 1998, 2000, we were in a bear market for commodities. And what has been striking over the last 10, 12 years is the very strong performance of commodities and obviously also of the Chinese economy that has really come a long way and is challenging now essentially the largest economy in the world, which is the United States. So these are two well-established trends. And, of course, commodities are unlikely to continue to appreciate at the same rate they have done in the last 10, 12 years. And there'll be setbacks. And also, we have to be aware that commodities do not move all in concert. In other words, the price of cocoa and coffee has nothing to do with the price of copper and of nickel and of aluminum. So different commodities will move at different times. But in general, that is the trend that has prevailed for the last 10 years. Very strong increases in commodity prices, especially until 2008. And the emergence of China as a very powerful and large economy on the world stage. In some sectors of the market, in some goods markets, they are the largest economy, say, for mobile phones and computers, internet users and so forth, due to its large population, which is twice as large as the U.S. and Europe combined.
So this trend for China obviously has been a growth trend, and going back to your book, Tomorrow's Gold, in the earlier part of this decade, you had looked at this expansion before it occurred in large part, and there does appear to be a slowing of growth from double digit now to single digit, still high, single digit growth, but some things that might portend a slowing in the Chinese economy, the Taiwanese trade and the Korean trade with China also in decline. Perhaps you could speak to the impact that that might have, the areas that are most vulnerable if this trend of declining growth in China is to continue. Is this an Australian story? Is this an industrial commodity story? Where do you think the greatest risks lie?
Well, I think that obviously we had very powerful growth in China until 2008, and then we had the global crisis, and the reaction of China was to print money massively. In other words, it was thereafter very strong credit growth and very large fiscal deficits. And I think that now the economy has slowed down much more than official statistics would suggest, because as you just pointed out, the more reliable statistics like trade from Korea, exports from Korea, exports from Taiwan, gambling revenues in Macau, electricity consumption, exports and so forth, is all down. So I think that obviously, if the Chinese economy has slowed down this much and will slow down further, with the debate, will we have a crash in the economy or just a major slowdown? But regardless, I think the demand for industrial commodities will not grow at the same rate it's grown in the last 10, 12 years.
You know, when we look at the rest of the world, two of the primary inputs, at least in terms of exports from China, would be to Europe and to the United States. And When we look at the Eurozone, they're still in crisis. Perhaps you could give us a brief summary of where the Eurozone is, in your opinion, and where it's going, if it is to survive in its current form.
Well, that's an easy question. I think the Eurozone is in recession. If you add up everything, there's one economy that is performing reasonably well, but there has been a significant slowdown as well, and that is Germany. The other economies are not growing anymore, and some of them are contracting. And I think that this is a structural shift that will not go over within half a year or 1 year. I think this is a very long-term problem. And so the exports from China to Europe will be disappointing. And at the same time, because of the slowdown in China, the exports from Germany and other European countries to China will be disappointing. And so we have essentially a weak global economic environment.
With this in mind, there's a variety of asset classes which have either done very well or hang in the balance in terms of risk and reward. We have the Fed, which does not seem to view the U.S. Treasury market as a bubble in spite of prices increasing for over 30 years and yields being pushed to incredibly low levels. Arguably, yields can still go lower, but you seem at this point to be more comfortable with the prospects of equities than betting on the competency of government or placing hard-earned capital in government bonds. Perhaps you could explore that.
Well, I think that if you print money, the difficulty is to know where the money will flow to. So it flowed into NASDAQ until March 2000, and then it created the world's biggest credit bubble until 2007. And that credit bubble then flowed into the housing market and created the housing bubble. And then in 2008, we had the commodities bubble and so forth. And I think that if I look at the valuations of equities around the world, they're not particularly high. They're reasonable. But who knows? Maybe the big bubble is in earnings. We have had a very strong recovery in corporate profits. In terms of margins, they're way above the average for the last 50 or 100 years. They're above the trend line. And the second bubble we may have is in government bonds and in fiscal deficit. And I think all these bubbles will eventually deflate one way or the other, maybe not voluntarily.
Looking at assets priced not in nominal terms but priced in gold, it appears that a great deflation has occurred and continues unabated with a radical increase in purchasing power over the last decade. Priced in gold, what assets, in your opinion, are most vulnerable today? Or to restate that, where might purchasing power radically improve from here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that selected real estate in the U.S. is inexpensive. And I think that, it's very difficult to value anything if interest rates are at zero. But, say, in Asia, we have lots of companies that have dividend yields of, say, 5%, 6%. So compared to zero interest rates on deposits and less than 2% on 10-year treasuries, I think that these stocks are reasonably okay, but they're not cheap. They're not as cheap as they were in March 2009. Most stocks around the world have actually doubled since March 2009, with the exception of the European market. So I don't think that anything is terribly cheap. I think in general, if I really had to make a bet what is relatively cheap, I would still argue that probably gold is relatively cheap because there has been a lot of money printing around the world. The debt has exploded everywhere. We have a government bond bubble. We have a fiscal deficit bubble and so forth. So I think that gold is probably still okay.
What is your sense of silver relative to gold or just as a standalone?
I have no idea. I mean, they move in the same direction. I prefer gold and other people prefer silver, but they'll move in the same direction. It's not going to be that gold goes up 20% and silver drops 20%. It's going to be gold and silver moving up together, maybe silver more than gold and maybe gold more than silver, or moving down together, maybe gold more and maybe silver more. That I don't know. But in general, obviously, they'll move together.
What could you say? We already have deflated assets, which offer, I guess, some protection via relative valuations. Perhaps these are safer than even traditional safe havens. For example, we could choose to own treasuries or German bunds today, Or on the other hand, you could consider Italian or Spanish equities, just as an example of a very depressed asset. Of course, you still have the currency devaluation risk implicit if you were to see the Spanish leave the Eurozone, or perhaps less likely the Italians leave the Eurozone. But how do you see this game today? An investor wants to preserve value, preserve assets, and yet the two, quote, safe havens, bonds and treasuries, from one perspective are very safe. From another perspective are perhaps the most risky asset out there. How do you parse, how do you understand risk and appraise that kind of a decision-making process?
Well, I think we have to start from the view that basically once a government intervenes into the market mechanism, the information system breaks down, the price information system breaks down, and so you can have a significantly distorted pricing mechanism. And I would argue, yes, in the case of bonds and the U.S. and JGBs and Swiss franc bonds and so forth, we have a completely disconnected market. And I think eventually the yields that are now extremely low will be far higher. But if you ask me, can the 10-year treasury drop once again to around 1.4%, 1%, it's possible. But over a 10-year period, say if we take an investment stance for the next 10 years, then I think equities are more attractive than, say, government bonds.
Keeping an open mind to all potential outcomes, let's look at deflation. If a deflationary scenario, a la Robert Prechter, is reasonable, is it a question of select assets deflating, particularly leveraged assets, which tend to carry a little bit more vulnerability, or is it just deflation of all assets from a particular level? We clearly have deleveraging like gravity, which seems to be a natural force at work in the market. But on the other hand, we have central bankers who are working against this trend with limited tools, which inherently seem inflationary. So you have this conflict. Do we go back to select asset classes or everything deflating, but just from a different level?
Well, I think if we looked at periods of heavy money printing in history, they are characterized by prices essentially moving up, but they don't move up in concert, and they don't move up in at the same time with the same intensity. In other words, as I just mentioned, until March 2000, we had a gross inflation in Nasdaq stocks, then we had the inflation in housing companies and in housing prices, and then in 2008, we had an increase from September 2007 in the case of oil, from $78 to a peak of $147 in July 2008. So different assets move up at different times. And the same happens in deflation. So I think that if someone took a very bearish view of the world and would think, well, the whole world is going to deflate, I would suggest that some home prices in the U.S. are near or close to a major low.
When we consider the options that we have today as investors, asset preservation has to be a core attempt, if you will, a core goal. And you've suggested that diversification is critical. Diversification because there is a requisite humility in the investment process, understanding that you don't know everything, you cannot predict the future. Maybe you can speak a little bit to diversification, as there's sometimes a temptation to load the boat in one direction.
Well, basically, my experience, especially over the last few years, has been that investors have performed very badly. In the 1980s and 1990s, whoever was long stocks performed reasonably well, whether it was long stocks in the U.S. or in Europe or in Asia. And that has now changed. And I think that in absence of knowing, we all know basically the consumer is in a bad shape. We know that the economy globally is not in a good shape. We know that the government have very heavy debts and very heavy fiscal deficits, and that these debts will be growing and so forth. So this we all know. But what we don't know is to what extent will central banks print money. I think they'll print probably more than is expected. And so in this money printing environment, I think that bonds, long-term government bonds, are not attractive, and equities are moderately attractive. They're not dramatically attractive, but they're moderately attractive.
This is perhaps a psychological or a philosophical question, but perhaps you can explore what takes place in a re-evaluation of risk. An asset previously believed to be safe and now scorned, for instance, GSEs, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac paper, which were, you know, truly the gold standard in the fixed income space, you know, giving you the best benefits of high income and the government guarantee. What does it take for perception to switch from something being safe to now being a risk asset?
Yes, this is a very good question, because let's say if we have kind of a gold standard and sound money, in other words, you have an environment where money is not being printed in unlimited quantities, then obviously, traditionally, the safest asset is to own cash and treasury bills and then government bonds and then municipals and corporate bonds and then equities, and the most risky are basically commodities. But in the current environment, say, looking ahead 10 years, we go on a holiday for 10 years and we come back, I think it would be very risky to put all your money into cash and hope that the purchasing power will be maintained over the next 10 years. I think it will go down substantially because we have negative real interest rates, and these negative real interest rates will continue. So under normal conditions, cash and government bonds is safe. But in this environment, in my view, it's no longer safe. Now, what is the safest? Is it gold or is it real estate at these distressed prices? Or is it equities? That we don't know for sure. But I'm quite sure that over the next 10 years, bonds are not a particularly desirable nor a particularly safe place to be positioned in.
So when we go back to that first assumption that if you look at bonds, if you look at treasuries, if you look at cash holdings as reliable on the basis that they are tied to a gold standard, do you foresee any time in the next decade or two an openness philosophically to a return to either partial remonetization or full remonetization, either in the West or in the East?
Well, I believe that today's system of government and central banks will not return to anything close to a gold standard. They are too deep in their mess. They will continue to print money and keep the system kind of humming along. But there will be a time when the system breaks down, and I think we had the first taste of it in 2008. In the meantime, the situation in the world has worsened in terms of the debt explosion. We have highly unstable markets, very volatile markets, and I think eventually the whole derivatives market will cease to exist. And the whole financial system will have to be redesigned. And at that stage, I suppose that gold will have a role to play, an important role to play. But as I said, it won't happen on the back of, say, government sitting together and say, we have to discipline ourselves more and so forth, let's go back to the gold standard. I think it will happen as a result of a major breakdown in the system.
Well, as we begin to wrap up, I'd love to get an outsider's perspective on what in the U.S. market will be significant, the elections which are pending, the election season which we're entering into. Does it really matter who takes office after November, so next year, 2013? Republicans, Democrats, how much is already baked into the cake, so to say, fiscally and economically? Or are there some real reforms which reasonably could be put in place to turn things around from an economic standpoint here in the United States?
Well, I think that the Democrats will argue that if the Republicans come into power, we have a fiscal cliff and problem and maybe social unrest. And I think that if and the Republicans will argue that it's a disaster if Obama is reelected and so forth. But quite frankly, to my mind, it won't make much of a difference. The fiscal deficit will stay at above $1 trillion, in my opinion, for as far as the eye can see. The spending pattern will be different. The Democrats will have more handouts, and the Republicans will have more defense spending. But the end result, in my view, is going to be pretty much the same, namely a very sluggish economy. Now, if you ask me what should be done, then obviously we would have to reduce in the Western world the involvement and the share of government in the economy as a percent of GDP. We would have to reduce that very meaningfully. When with the states, municipalities, and the federal government, the U.S. is about 45% government-related. You understand, it's a very large portion. And that stifles economic growth. At the same time, and this is really the work and the merit of Mr. Obama, we have an increasingly cumbersome regulatory environment which just makes it very unappealing for any business to expand, especially the medium-sized and smaller businesses. They're faced or confronted with a huge increase in regulatory costs. And so they say to themselves, well, why would we hire under these conditions? Why would we expand under these conditions? We better don't do anything. So I think that both under the Republicans and under the Democrats, we have a structural problem that both parties will not solve because of the dysfunctional nature of the U.S. government at the present time.
And perhaps just an insight, as you are originally from Switzerland and have seen many changes in Switzerland over the last 20, 30 years, and perhaps even more changes over the last 20 to 30 months, what is your sense of what is taking place in Switzerland, both in terms of linking the currency to the euro, keeping it pegged at 1.2 to the euro, and even just what's taking place in the banking community? What are the pros and cons of Switzerland today?
Well, I mean, for the first time in my life, I'm actually deeply disappointed to be a Swiss. I like the Swiss passport, travel around and so forth, and it's convenient. But I have to say that, A, to peg the currency against the euro is a huge mistake, And they're going to pay for it eventually. Number two, I think it's a disgrace that the Swiss banks that essentially encourage people to gather assets all over the world from essentially people that were tax dodgers, that they would hand out to the American Department of Justice thousands and thousands of names of bank employees. I mean, I think we are a sovereign state and we should stand to that and not just hand out any kind of document. But there we have it. And I have to say, as a Swiss, I'm deeply disappointed by this. But then again, I'm also maintaining the view, never trust any government, anywhere in the world.
Well, what we appreciate is we look at your newsletter on a monthly basis and have enjoyed these conversations going back now to 2008. The regular conversations with you is that you start with a deep philosophical basis. You're well-read, well-traveled, well-educated, but that education has come in more than just degrees and formal study. And we appreciate the insight that you bring. It is, it's a unique one. And we just want to thank you for the contribution that you make.
Well, thank you very much. But as I said, you know, you can be, no matter how well-educated you are, we just don't know exactly how the future will be. And that's why I want essentially my readers and my investors to sleep at night, because money is the stress factor number one. By being diversified and not overly exposed into just one asset class, you sleep better. Because I get so many emails from people, they worry because the price of gold has gone down. Why do they worry? Yes, they worry because they have all their money in gold. I also like gold, but I wouldn't put everything in gold, and especially not on margin. There are people, they shorted the S&P 50 points below where it is today. I don't think that this is necessarily a very wise decision, because you don't know how much money will be printed. I think that market action is horrible. I think the technical conditions have deteriorated, but it doesn't mean that the market will go down right away. We could go up another 100 points from this relatively poor technical condition. I don't think it will happen. It is not a projection. And I think the market will probably peak out within the next 10 days. Then we'll have a meaningful correction. And then we'll have to see what follows. But in general, I think it's difficult to predict markets when they are perfect markets. In other words, no participant has a dominant position in the market. It's impossible to predict the market that is manipulated.
your sense is that today we have a higher level of manipulation in the markets, that being government intervention in the pricing structure, interest rates being suppressed beyond a natural rate and distorting pricing, perhaps across all asset classes. So price discovery is something that we don't have access to.
I think we have almost as much manipulation as, say, a socialist, communist, planning economy would have over the distribution of goods and services and the consumption of goods and services in an economy. We have a completely manipulated market, and the only reason the market has doubled since March 2009, I'm not complaining because I saw it coming, it's money printing. Without the money printing, the S&P would be at 500-600. But with the money printing, we had this profit inflation, and we had the money flowing not into hiring new people, not into capital spending, but we have the money flowing essentially into speculation, mostly in equities.
Well, the two Bens have a lot to do with the next 60 days of market behavior. Benjamin Netanyahu could certainly aliven things a bit in terms of Middle East conflict, and Benjamin Bernanke could certainly heat things up in a pre-announcement coming into Jackson Hole. Do you have any opinion in terms of the two Bens?
Well, I think the announcement by whatever Mr. Bernanke does, I think the market has fully discounted it already. That's why I'm not very optimistic about the market at this stage. And that's why I said I think we'll reach an intermediate peak either today or within the next 5-6 trading days. The other, Israel attacking Iran, is a possibility. But if you think about it, what would happen, obviously, it would happen with the consent of the U.S., and the reaction to any market weakness would then be guaranteed money printing, but guaranteed. So again, you know, you have a disconnect because between the economic reality, which is green around the world, and the performance of equities, because the money is flowing somewhere and people don't trust cash anymore. And so it goes essentially into some assets, whether it's paintings or gold or diamonds or stamps or farmland or now again more real estate and so forth. And you just don't know exactly which one will be the best performing asset. But in general, I would say, I think with Bernanke at the Fed, and if Mr. Romney gets elected, there will be most likely Mankiw. He's, of course, an even greater money print than Mr. Bernanke. So we are looking forward to more and more money printing.
Well, I appreciate you joining us. It's late there in Asia, and we look forward to having you back into the conversation at some point in the future.
Thank you very much.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Mark Fopper. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.